From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll speak with writer Joyce Carol Oates. Her latest book, titled On Boxing, looks at the sport's mystique. Also today, I try to have a conversation with comic Emo Phillips. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the work of composer John Harbison, who won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will talk about Americans' appalling ignorance of foreign languages. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Carol Oates. She's one of the most versatile and prolific American writers. Her novels include Them, Do With Me What You Will, Belle Fleur, and Maria, A Life. The critic Alfred Kazin has said of Oates' writing that it comes from someone who is dreaming all the time she's awake. Many of her characters lead everyday lives that end up filled with mystery and terror and often veer beyond control or comprehension. Joyce Carol Oates' latest book is an essay titled On Boxing. It's a meditation on the violent and controversial sport. She calls it America's tragic theater for the way it consumes the very excellence it displays. Joyce Carol Oates lives in Princeton with her husband Raymond Smith, with whom she edits the Ontario Review, a literary journal they founded. Since 1978, Joyce Carol Oates has taught creative writing at Princeton University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I was surprised, and I think I certainly wasn't the only reader of yours who was surprised to find that you're a fan of boxing. How did you first become interested in the sport?
I became interested in it, in a sense, when I was really too young to know what it was or what it symbolized or really anything. I was probably quite a young child, younger than 10. My father took me to Golden Gloves tournaments in Buffalo, New York. And I think, like most children who are brought to some new and somewhat mysterious world by a parent, it came to me with the force of a revelation. It wasn't that I was assessing it or critical of it or even in a way a fan, but just that it seemed to perhaps symbolize something very arcane and mysterious and exciting, a kind of adult world.
What's your interest in it as a writer? Does it have literary significance for you?
Well, that really came much later. I've always been fascinated by certain elements in what one could say the human spirit in contention, a kind of divided self. And I'm also interested in just the phenomenon of twins, which in some unconscious way seems to be suggested by two boxers in the ring who are so well matched.
Some people think of boxing as exploiting our worst instincts, of being almost like the old gladiator fights. Do you think that that's a valid way of looking at it?
It's very hard to answer that. When I approached boxing, it was as a cultural phenomenon. As a novelist, I'm very interested in American history and American culture, what might be called loosely American studies. So I was approaching boxing from the outside as a woman and a feminist, and then someone who knew a bit about it because of my background. My father had been friends with a boxer, and he followed boxing quite assiduously, especially in the early 50s. And so it really grew or evolved from that in a kind of unplanned and in a way uncoordinated method.
But would you agree with the people who say that boxing exploits our worst instincts by having us cheer for people who are punching each other out?
I don't really know how to answer that. I think the idea of what art does for us or what sports do for us is very, very difficult. If we see an excellent production of King Lear, for instance, we're sort of transported beyond the surface, let's say. We are subjected to seeing a man whose eyes are being put out on stage and it's simulated. Then with boxing and with other sports that might be called blood sports or blood activities, some of the same aesthetic principles are going on there. It's a vicarious experience. I don't know if it exploits the passions of the onlookers or whether it exploits the passions of the participants.
I want to quote Michael Tyson. You quote this in your book. He's a boxer who said, "I tried to catch my opponent at the tip of the nose because I want to punch the bone into the brain." And he makes it sound like a craft, you know, like a cabinet maker might say about how they want, like, to, you know, cut something to size so it makes a beautifully formed cabinet, except he's talking about punching a bone into a brain. What's your gut reaction to a quote like that?
It seemed to me just extraordinary, because you're quite right, Terry. He does approach boxing. He has been trained to approach it that way by a wonderful trainer named Castamato, who's sort of legendary in the boxing world. But to approach it as a skill, as a craft, as an art, with very carefully calibrated and designated parts of the body that one tries for, I suppose not unlike karate. Well, I thought it was very interesting, because I've gotten to know Mike a bit. I'm not a close friend of Mike Tyson's by any means, but I know people who know him very, very well, and he's a very warm and, in a way, ingenuous young man. He can be very sweet. It's just that in the territory of the ring, another personality steps forward. I don't mean that it's a primordial personality, though it's probably fueled by that instinct. Because, in fact, boxing of the caliber of Tyson's is very, very highly trained. It's not instinctive, and it's not primitive. Boxing is not really an instinctive art. As I say, though, it's fueled by these rather instinctive emotions.
You mean by it's not instinctive? It's not instinctive because it's so disciplined. You have to know exactly what you're going for. You have to be in training. It's not just that, oh, I hate this guy, I'm going to punch him out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's very highly trained. And in some ways awkward, I think, to learn to be a boxer. One has to relearn or completely learn a whole different set of priorities, I think, in terms of leverage and timing and so forth. It's primarily the art of self-defense, or ideally it's supposed to be a self-defense. That is, one hits, but one doesn't get hit in return.
But then you have a quote in your book from Marvin Hagler, who said, "When I see blood, I become a bull."
Hagler meant his own blood.
Excuse me?
Hagler meant his own blood.
Oh, I thought he meant when he saw the blood of when he saw a bleeding face in the ring, that he just wanted to make that wound even bigger.
I think that's probably true for most boxers. It's supposed to be an atavistic and absolutely irresistible feeling, that when an opponent is bloodied, that the sight of the blood just unleashes some other level of energy. But what Hagler meant was that, like all boxers who have been hurt, and Hagler's skin has been getting progressively thinner, he bleeds more easily. It's this characteristic of somewhat older boxers. He means that the fight may be stopped within seconds. Consequently, he has to knock his opponent out, or he may lose the fight on a technical knockout.
You have an interesting observation. You say that you think boxing is more about bearing the pain than it is about inflicting pain, and that it becomes more of a masochistic than a sadistic sport.
Well, words like masochism and sadism have to be really dealt with quotation marks around them, because they tend to be extremely abstract and, in a way, sort of careless words. Nobody knows what they mean exactly. And when I talk about masochism, I usually being somewhat speculative about it, because I think that writing is also a very masochistic activity. And perhaps
right.
Most of the things that we do that involve some kind of work and discipline and delayed gratification are masochistic. But obviously boxing, for most boxers, involves a good deal of pain. Even for boxers who are champions and who have triumphed, like Sugar Ray Leonard, much pain has gone into it. And the training alone is just so arduous, so onerous and difficult, that when I've seen Mike Tyson train and work out, and I've never really seen any human being exert himself like that, to the point at which sweat was just exuding from his pores, just as if his body were weeping, and yet he wasn't out of breath. And that's really a phenomenon. We don't usually see anyone in quite that state.
Have you ever seen a match in real time, not tape delayed or 10 years after the fact, but in real time, where you could tell and the viewers could start to tell that someone was in the process of being killed, yet the referee wasn't ending the match.
You mean, have I ever seen a live match when mm-hmm. someone was killed?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely not. No, those matches are very, very rare. Very rare.
But you've seen them on tape playbacks.
Well, I saw them deliberately on tape. I saw Ray Mancini and Duck Koo Kim, and I saw Johnny Owen fight of bantamweight fight of some years ago.
What was your gut reaction to that? Because as you were saying before, that kind of violence and that kind of death is very different than death in the theater, which we know is just fake. Yeah, this is real.
I deliberately saw those tapes by way of a friend because I was writing this book and I just wanted to address that subject, the fatalities in the ring, the dangers to the boxers. And strange as it may sound, it was because Johnny Owen and Duk Koo Kim were so courageous. They kept fighting, they kept getting up, they were knocked down. They were obviously being pushed beyond the limits of most human beings' endurance, where another boxer, or most boxers, would have given up. And these fights should have been stopped by the referees in each case. Where other boxers would have given up, they just kept on. And it was because of that they died. Duk Koo Kim was very evenly matched, as it turned out, with Ray Mancini. And when one sees the two of them fighting, the Korean boxer seems like a shadow self or a mirror self, a twin of Mancini. So it was a really eerie and uncanny fight. Before the match, some days before, Duk Koo Kim allegedly written on a lampshade in Korean, kill or be killed, which is presumably a slogan or a watchword of the martial arts, so that he thought of it as a fight to the death. He was willing to have it be that. Whereas Ray Mancini, I'm sure, was just defending his title.
When you were watching that fight, were you yelling at the screen saying, "No, stop it, stop it"?
Oh, no. To me, this was history.
Uh-huh, right.
And I find it very, very hard to see live fights, particularly fights of the caliber, say, of Mike Tyson's. I saw the Mike Tyson fight the other evening with Pinklin Thomas. I didn't see it live. I saw it on HBO, but it was live on HBO. And that was very, very difficult for me, now that I know Mike Tyson.
Oh, because you were worried that he'd get hurt?
I don't know what to say. In a sense, nobody worries that Mike Tyson's going to get hurt. He's an excellent defensive boxer. I can't analyze it. Just that now that I know him, I have a different feeling about boxing because the aesthetic distance, let's say, is more or less erased if you know somebody.
I think a sport like boxing has really changed by whether you're watching it at home on TV, whether you're actually in the ring with the cheering crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Which place do you prefer to be? You know, in the arena or at home?
Well, they're completely different. First of all, if you watch television, you're not seeing the real fight, but seeing a kind of cosmeticized version of it. And it's framed by the television screen, of course. You also have the voiceover of the announcers who impose a kind of narrative on something that's happening without any language. Boxing matches are completely silent, like most sports activities. And the narrator, the announcers, impose a narration on it that in some cases is misleading, but most of the time is very helpful, so that you have a sense of its being a story and having a movement to it and a kind of unity that you don't get when you're seeing it live. It's much less obviously brutal when it is brutal. You see it on television. Now, when you see it live, you're seeing something that is close to the thing in itself, but then because it's live, it moves very quickly, and you often don't know what your eye has seen. The eye takes in things that the brain can't really, really absorb or monitor. So there are advantages and disadvantages of both. I think ideally, when I was doing the Mike Tyson interview for Life magazine, ideally I saw a live fight, and then I was able to see it on tape, and I could see it over and over again several times, so that then I had the advantages of both media.
My guest is writer Joyce Carol Oates, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Joyce Carol Oates, and we're talking about the subject of her latest book, which is called On Boxing. I bet you feel lucky that you were exposed to boxing as a young girl, and I mean that in part because sometimes it's really good for a girl who might be exposed to all the, quote, female things, to be exposed to some of the, quote, male things to balance out her life.
Yes, absolutely. I think it allowed me a way into a kind of window into another world, very antithetical to my own. And then for many, many years, even for decades, it was more or less an abeyance because I didn't continue following the sport until a few years ago when I started researching a novel. And the novel was going to be set in between the years 1946 and 1956. So I did a lot of research into the politics of the era, the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, the trial of the Rosenbergs, and so on and so forth. But the cultural element that I looked into was boxing, because the sport was so very much at its zenith at that time. It reached its zenith in the 20s with Jack Dempsey, and then again in that era with Rocky Marciano was the heavyweight title holder, and was sort of the end of Joe Louis's long reign. It was just very exciting, and millions of Americans watched boxing every week on television to a much greater extent, of course, than they do now.
When you were a girl, were boys surprised that you knew something about boxing and that you liked to watch it?
I don't really remember.
I remember the thing that scared me most about boxing was the whole idea of somebody's eye being razored open so that they could see. It still really appalls me.
Razored open?
Yeah. Cutting somebody's eye so that they can see out of it when it's been punched and it's all swollen, like in the film Rocky?
Oh, well, I don't think the film Rocky is any sort of...
They do that, don't they, though? I'd heard about that for years.
They don't do it. In my experience.
Really?
It doesn't seem to be part of what I know about boxing.
You've taken something of a feminist perspective on boxing in our culture. In what ways do you see your book as being feminist?
It was really informed by a feminist perspective. I was looking at what might be called a quintessentially masculine activity. In a sense, the boxers are almost parodies of masculinity. And I don't mean to suggest that all men are defined by boxing, because clearly they're not. But I was interested in it completely from the outside as a feminist, as a woman, with a kind of anthropological distance, or so I thought, though it was linked up emotionally with my own childhood. And I thought it would be much more critical of the sport and of those who surrounded, but as I got into it, I saw really hundreds of fights on film and tape and did a lot of reading. As I got more and more into it, I became more and more sympathetic with the boxers and with their predicament, so to speak, because they're in a certain economic context, of course. Jack Dempsey said, oh, there's only one thing a man fights for, and that's money. And virtually all boxers are from very impoverished backgrounds or ghetto neighborhoods, and they're fighting to raise themselves from these neighborhoods.
Yeah, there's two different sides to that particular coin. One is that it's really a blessing that if they're a good fighter, they can make a lot of money and get out of this really poor life. On the other hand, it almost feels like the message we're giving poor, especially blacks and Hispanics in America is, well, if you could fight well for our entertainment, you have your ticket out.
It's very paradoxical. It's completely paradoxical, because there isn't any boxer, including Muhammad Ali, who would not have chosen boxing. Muhammad Ali, who now seems perhaps brain damage is too strong a word, but he suffers from something rather like Parkinson's disease. But Muhammad Ali made choices along the line, a choice of continuing to box when he was told by his physician he should stop boxing. And it seems to be a world. I've tried to explore this in my novel, which is called You Must Remember This, and it's coming out in August. I tried to explore this from the point of view of a boxer who sees the ring as that one arena in life, perhaps the only arena in life, in which everything you do, every choice you make, has an immediate and opposite reaction. That is, you in the real world, in the world outside the ring, virtually, you know, all of what we do can be attributed to chance. Things are done to us, things happen accidentally. But in a sport like boxing, the man is all alone. He isn't even with a team. He's all alone in the ring in a kind of nightmare exaggeration of the plight that we all have in terms of being alone. But his opponent's strength is really his own weakness. That is, if you have a very good defense and you've trained very well, you're in good condition, you probably can't be hurt. If you're a good boxer, then you're going to win your fight. If you're not so good, you shouldn't have gotten in the ring. So in the book, I was trying to explore the philosophical or psychological underpinnings of such a world, and I thought it was analogous almost to this harsh religions that we call Calvinistic, where everything you do is your own fault. At the same time, it's a completely predetermined world, which is this cruel, harsh God, rather like a Darwinian force.
Are you reaching different readers with your writing on boxing than you've ever reached with your novels and essays?
Yes, I think I'm reaching readers who don't read books, which is kind of a revelation to me that I have been invited to be interviewed by people who are basically interested in sports, sports writers. And I've met many letters from virtually all letters from men. Some of them have been boxers and some are interested in boxing. I would guess that most of them don't read literary books at all and have no interest in literary books.
Is this refreshing for you?
It's interesting. It's surprising. My writer friends who are men, I have a lot of men writer friends, say that they're very jealous of me because they would have wanted to reach an audience like this. And I was interviewed by George Vexey of the New York Times.
The sports writer.
And my colleagues at Princeton were just terribly impressed with them because the sports pages are the pages that they really read and take seriously, whereas the book review is something that they find themselves in either because the books are reviewed or because they write for it themselves. So they don't find that quite as unusual.
I know readers of your novels frequently ask you about all the violence that appears in your novels. Do you see any connection between your interest in boxing and the sometimes violent explosions that take place in your books?
Well, some of these questions, I think, are in a way naive because I'm primarily a writer about America. And if I were a male writer, probably nobody would think my writing was violent. It just seems to be that there are certain preconceptions that women should be writing about tremulous states of being or and some kind of equivalent of needlepoint. And so when a woman writes simply about what's out there in the way that Norman Mailer does or Faulkner did or Melville and so on and so forth, and people seem to be surprised. But I'd say in both cases I'm primarily interested in a phenomenon that exists and by way of trying to understand it, to look upon boxing, say, as a kind of symbol and to use it as a window or a way into an understanding. I think that really is my primary impetus.
In a way, you live a pretty sheltered, isolated life. You live in Princeton in a home that I think's set back from a lot of the other houses. I don't know if you're surrounded by woods, but that's the impression I've gotten. And you teach at Princeton, but your writing is very much in the world in a lot of ways, not necessarily even in the century, but it seems almost a contradiction between your writing and your life, the isolation of your writing and the isolation of your life and the engagement of your writing.
There have probably not been very many writers. We could probably sit and name them, have we time, who've been completely immersed in the world, you know, very actively immersed. Hemingway comes most immediately to mind, but this was perhaps to his own, ultimately to his own detriment, because he injured himself so many times. But I think the act of writing is an act of reflection and placing structure on experiences that might seem to be rather inchoate. So that if one is going to be a writer or, say, a poet, that by definition one is not going to be in the fray. However, like all human beings, I'm very much involved in happiness and unhappiness and chance and accident and various things that happen to us all simply by living. And my background in itself could be defined rather more as working class. It certainly was not middle class.
Your husband runs a literary press. Now, I remember that you've said that you don't like him to read your writing, and I wonder if that's still the case, that he doesn't read your novels.
No, he doesn't read my writing. Sometimes he'll read a nonfiction essay or a review, but not the fiction. And it simply has worked out that way. I'm often asked that question as if it were something very strange. And I don't think of it as strange, but just that I need or I require some kind of private psychic space where someone whom I love very much and who is very close to me nonetheless doesn't have access to this particular space, which could be called the imagination.
Is it also so that you don't have to be living with a literary critic of your work?
That may well be. That may well be. We're so sensitive to criticism, even those of us who should know better.
It could kind of paralyze you, I think, if you've shown someone who you live with a chapter and they don't like it.
Exactly.
Then you have to feel like you're deluding yourself into thinking that it's good.
Yes, exactly. And it puts an unfair burden on that person because nobody really knows. There is no truth in art. There are only opinions.
One thing I have to ask you, you really are one of the most prolific writers in the country, I think. Do you write most hours of the day? How do you keep it up? I know you must be asked that a lot. But.
Well, it doesn't seem to me that I'm that prolific because it seems to me I'm always going very slowly. Like this morning I may have done one page, and that seemed to come after great effort and strain. So I've sort of come to think that I inhabit different time from other people. The rhythm or the pace is just different.
How so?
That I work very slowly and take great pains and do a lot of revision, but then people on the outside think that I write very quickly. And there's some sort of mystery here which I will have to live with since I can't explain it.
Do you find time to read with all the writing that you do?
I read in the evenings.
Because I see a lot of your book reviews, so I figure you must.
Yeah, I enjoy reading very much. That's a kind of reward for the strain of writing. The writing is not easy.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Joyce Carol Oates, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for visiting with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been novelist and essayist Joyce Carol Oates, and her latest book is called On Boxing. It's published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll speak with Derek Taylor. He's a former press agent for the Beatles and author of the new book, It Was 20 Years Ago Today. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, comic Emo Phillips explains why ambiguity is the volleyball of the devil. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of music by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Harbison. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the sad state of foreign language instruction in the United States, and we'll get a look at the day's news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news.
I'm Ann Bozell. Albert Hakim, the man who handled the money for the arms sales to Iran, testified before the Iran-Contra committees today. He said some of the profits from those sales were set aside for Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, although North didn't know it. NPR's Linda Wertheimer has more.
Albert Hakim told the committee that he had come to love Oliver North during the course of what Hakim and his business partner Major General Richard Secord called the enterprise, the arms sales to Iran and arms sales to the Contras in Nicaragua. Hakim worked event that something happened to him. Around the time of North's trip to Iran with Robert McFarland to negotiate for the return of American hostages, Hakim set aside $200,000 for North. Hakim says he does not remember telling North about the fund. He did tell North that he considered him part of the family and that his family would be taken care of. Hakim later tried to find a way to use the interest income from the $200,000 for an education fund for North's daughters, but could find no way to funnel the money to the family. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington.
Democratic Representative Mario Biaggi of New York and six other people, including his son, were indicted today on racketeering charges in connection with the WedTech Corporation investigation. The indictment charges that Congressman Biaggi demanded and received 225,000 shares of WedTech stock by threatening to end his law firm's legal representation of the firm before the Small Business Administration. WedTech is a bronze defense contractor under investigation for allegedly bribing as many as 20 public officials. The State Department confirmed today that a U.S. Foreign Service officer has been arrested and charged with fraud. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
A 19-year veteran with the Foreign Service, Bernard J. Fennell, headed the visa unit at the American Embassy in Madrid. According to the indictment, he conspired with Harry Arjad, a naturalized U.S. citizen who solicited money from Iranians in exchange for U.S. visas. Fennell has been recalled from Spain, and he was arrested at the State Department yesterday. At least four Iranians entered the U.S. with the false visas and are now being held by immigration authorities in New York City. They, along with Arjad and Fennell, have been named in the 21-count indictment. Fennell has been placed on administrative leave. His security clearance has been suspended. An administration official told NPR there's nothing to indicate that embassy secrets were compromised as a result of Fennell's actions. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Pentagon released the preliminary findings today of the joint U.S.-Iraqi investigation into last month's attack on the USS Stark. Kathleen Dulaski reports.
Rear Admiral David Rogers, who headed the investigation, released a memo today that says the U.S. and Iraq cannot agree on an important detail of the incident. That is, the location of the USS Stark at the time of the attack. According to Rogers, the Iraqis say the ship was inside an Iranian-declared war zone, and therefore the pilot assumed it was an Iranian ship. The U.S. Navy maintains that the Stark was 14 miles west of the war zone in international waters. U.S. investigators say they are certain of the location because of a wealth of data from the Stark, two other ships, and AWACS, or early warning radar planes. The preliminary report also revealed that the Stark's commander did attempt to shoot back at the warplane in the few seconds before it was hit. I'm Kathleen Dulaski in Washington.
A new poll has found a majority of Americans feel there is a high risk of the U.S. getting into a war in the Persian Gulf. But the poll by the L.A. Times also found that many people don't know where the Persian Gulf is. Fewer than 6 out of 10 knew that it is in the Middle East. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up more than 42 points to close at 2320.69. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This has been a good year for American composer John Harbison. In April, he won a Pulitzer Prize, and last month, his Symphony No. 2 was premiered in San Francisco. These accomplishments and a recent recording of two of his works have prompted these thoughts from our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz.
This year's well-deserved Pulitzer Prize in Music went to John Harbison's darkly radiant The Flight into Egypt, a Christmas cantata whose spiritual message is less about Christmas than the plight of the homeless. This intersection of the spiritual and the realistic is typical of the paradoxes in Harbison's music. He's been called both a radical conservative and a conservative radical, a new romantic, a tune man. I think this means that his music combines sophisticated modern techniques, polyrhythms, tone rows, palindromes, with such current anomalies as melody and harmony. He writes chamber music, symphonies, concertos, song cycles, and even operas. His musical imagery embraces mysticism and ritual as well as jazz and popular music. Harbison himself plays both classical viola and jazz piano. He actually seems to want to write music that is both beautiful and moving. The two pieces of his on a new Northeastern record were composed 5 years ago, but they demonstrate his continuing fascination with the earthy and the sublime. The Mirabai songs are settings of 6 poems by the 16th century Indian mystic poet Mirabai. When her husband died, she took to the streets instead of the funeral pyre, singing and dancing her own witty, erotically spiritual poems about Krishna. Listen to the alluring sensuality of the 4th song, Where Did You Go, My Holy One? The superb musicians for John Harbison's Mirabai songs are members of Collage, the group of mostly Boston Symphony players that Harbison co-directs. He's also been composer in residence with the Los Angeles Philharmonic for the past 2 years. The soloist, mezzo-soprano Janice Felty, is one of the 6 dedicatees of these 6 songs. She's a dedicated singer, but she lacks Mirabai's volatility, her dancing energy, the sense of ecstatic fun these songs require. You can also hear a good deal of strain in her voice, and too often you can't make out the words. I wish the record had been made with the extraordinary Susan Larson, who sang the premiere of the original and even more exciting version with only piano accompaniment. The unqualified joy of this new Harbison CD are the variations for violin, clarinet, and piano. They seem completely abstract, But they were actually inspired by a sculpture of a Canaanite fertility goddess, dancing like Mirabai. In 15 brief variations, plus finale and epilogue, Harbison mixes his three instruments in every conceivable combination, tempo, and style. There's even a waltz. These variations build a musical arch that reaches an ecstatic climax and then dies away into introspection and elegy. Here's the end of the waltz and the beginning of the haunting 14th variation. Players on John Harbison's variations are David Zatz on clarinet, Ursula Oppens piano, and the brilliantly expressive violinist Rosemary Harbison, who isn't on this record only because she happens to be married to the composer.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed John Harbison Mirabai Songs Variations. Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Emo Phillips. As Emo tells it, he was born in Chicago, and when he was 10, his parents moved to Downers Grove, Illinois. When he was 12, he found them. Emo suffered from asthma and was beaten up by bullies, but this sad childhood is now a rich source of material for his act. Emo's big break came after his first appearance on Late Night with David Letterman. He recently had an HBO special, which is the basis of his new record album, Live at the Hasty Pudding Theater. Emo says that when he performs, he wants people to see the show and walk out afterwards saying, "Well, we got that over with." Emo is tall and gawky and has a Prince Valiant haircut. He acts like he never quite grew up. He appears in patterned polyester pants, belted above the waist, tight-fitting pajama tops from the boys' department, and tongueless shoes. I couldn't see Emo during our interview since he was at the NPR studio in New York, so I asked him what he was wearing.
Well, I'm in a sequined outfit. There's little bangles coming down from my breasts, and it's real nice. And I'm wearing hip-high nylon boots, and a Viking helmet.
Did anyone pick on you on the way over dressed like that?
Actually, I'm kidding. It's the radio. Actually, I'm dressed in a 14th century Florentine nobleman outfit.
Do you ever dress as a normal person so that people don't recognize you on the street?
Well, people always recognize me. I'll walk down the street and people will say, "You're Emo, you're Emo." And they'll give me a subpoena.
Do you accept?
Oh, yeah. I accept it very well, or else a regular-sized one. You know Terry?
Yes.
You know what, Terry? You're a hot mama. I'm quite handy with the ladies myself, you know. You probably think you're superior to my girlfriend, don't you? Just because you're real. Well, little Miss Tangible, I'm sorry. Go on.
So you have a girlfriend, huh, Emo?
Yeah. She's sexy, you know. She makes me wish I never had that accident through the turnstile.
Do you ever have to prove your masculinity with her?
Only with geometric proofs. Like on a blackboard, I'll write, like, given A, Emo is a man. And, you know, we prove it, you know, abstractly.
I bet women are very protective of you because you seem so vulnerable.
Woman protective? Yeah, I'm very vulnerable, actually. You should see the wounds. But you can't be too careful these days, right, Terry?
That's right, and I'm sure you know from experience.
Yeah, well, I just said so. If you weren't so busy shooting up during that one, maybe... I'm sorry, I'm bitter today. You know what, Terry?
What?
Some mornings, it just doesn't pay to gnaw through those leather straps.
Emo, were you bullied a lot as a kid?
I was often beat up a lot. Yeah, but it was okay, you know. I mean, like Nietzsche said, that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger.
You grew up in a suburb of Chicago. Do you think it would have been worse in the city? Are kids less tough in the suburbs when it comes to beating you up?
Well, the only difference is in the suburbs, when they're beating you up, they knock off to watch Leave It to Beaver. But they will come right after you after it's over, you know? It was a pretty tough. I had my own street gang in Downers Grove. The Insane White Eunuchs and Connie Francis impersonators. And we were very tough. Once we were walking down the street, and this little patrol boy told us to stop, and we just ran across the street. The little fairy. He only caught like 12 of us.
Did you want to be an athlete when you were a kid?
Yes, Terry. I often played baseball. I was always the catcher, which I liked. Until one day I saw a game on television, and I said, well, hold on there now. How come that catcher doesn't have his hands tied to his ankles?
Did the athletic kids make you nervous because you couldn't be like them?
Well, actually, I'm very athletic, you know. I'm pretty athletic. I mean, when I was a little boy, the other kids always played tetherball with me because I had a weak neck.
Did you stay in your...
Your turn.
Oh, I don't have any water. I can't gargle.
Oh.
Did you stay in your room a lot as a kid, watching television?
Well, I used to read books a lot, and I was always a bookworm, but I like to read books even now. You know what I'm reading?
What?
I'm reading two books at a time now, because I'm so busy. Right now I'm reading, it's by, I think, Henry James Joyce, and it's called Portrait of a Lady as a Young Man. It's about this transvestite in Ireland, I believe.
When did you become aware that ambiguity is the devil's volleyball?
Well, I was in a movie theater, and this guy said, excuse me, is this seat saved? I said, well, if Aquinas reasoned that even animals have no souls, I mean, how much less chance does an inanimate object like a chair have of gaining salvation, Mr. Theologian? And he said, no, I mean, is anyone sitting here? So ambiguity is the devil's volleyball, or bocce ball, as they say in New Jersey.
Are you as sensitive to the dangers of paradox and synonyms and double meanings?
Oh, yes. I was at a party, you know, with my nephew. He said, Uncle Emo? I'm sorry, what was the question?
Are you as sensitive to the dangers of paradox and double meanings and synonyms?
Yes, indeed. I was at a party with my nephew, and I said, okay, blow up the candles on the coleslaw. He said, I want to make a wish, I want to make a wish. So I grab him by the ankles and start spinning him, and goes, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. See, I knew what he really meant, Terry, but I thought, what a good time to warn him about the dangers of homonyms. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Okay. All these people are in the studio right now looking at me through the glass, wondering why I'm not talking about Nicaragua.
We get to that later, so tell them not to worry.
Okay, this is National Public Radio.
Emo, are you secretly a well-adjusted person underneath it all?
I have a very well-adjusted attitude toward life, you know, Terry. I try to live the kind of a life so that when I die, there won't be that much of a drop-off.
Are you going to have children?
Well, Terry, that all depends on you.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't mind having a couple of kids that I could probably call my own. I love children. My sister had me babysit the other day, And I'm pushing him through the park, and he's crying, you know, because I forgot the stroller.
Well, what about your parents? What do they think of you? I mean, the way you turned out isn't exactly a testament to their great parenting skills, huh?
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, if my mom could see me here today, she'd say, Emo, how did you escape from the attic?
Emo, you sing some good songs. Now, did you ever write songs when you were a kid, and can you remember any that you would sing for us?
When I was just a little boy, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Buzz off, scum!
You know, you didn't write that whole song yourself.
No?
No.
Oh, well, that's good. I thought for a second I was Doris Day.
Did you ever meet Pee Wee Herman?
Oh, no, it's been one of the great chinks in my cultural armor that I haven't.
Would you want to?
I like Pee-wee. Personally, I think I lack his maturity.
There's one last thing I really do want to ask you. You have terrific enunciation. You really do.
Thank you. Well, I try to say every word as if it were my last.
Okay. And with that, I'll thank you very much for doing the interview, Emo Phillips.
Well, maybe I could take your job if I have good enunciation.
We'll talk about that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Terry. Nice to meet a girl of the cloth.
That's comic Emo Phillips. His first album, E equals MO squared, features this tribute to his hometown.
I like to shop in downtown Downers Grove. It doesn't take big bucks, and everyone there really is nice. I went into the bakery just the other day. I said to the girl, do you have a wee back? She said, I always slouch this way. I went into the pet shop, said, I want a parrot. The guy said, how about a cockatoo? I said, no thanks, just the bird.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
What stories are you following today?
Terry, today we'll take a look at British elections. One of the big issues there is the economy. Also, a Philadelphia minister today called for an abandonment of what's come to be known as the Sullivan Principles. Reverend Leon Sullivan came up some years ago with a code of fair employment practices that have been adopted by more than 100 companies, American companies, doing business in South Africa. Today he says he wants American businesses to pull out. And in Mexico, they've bred cows down to a height of 2 feet. We're doing a story on this. The idea is that you can put more cows on the same small amount of land and get more milk.
Okay, thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Having pride in things American is one thing, but our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says, when it comes to our language, we go too far.
I once heard a story about an Oklahoma superintendent of schools who refused to allow the teaching of foreign languages to his students on the grounds that if English was good enough for Jesus, he guessed it was good enough for them. Now, this is doubtless apocryphal and a libel on the people of a great state, but it does point out a very real problem, one that I wish we'd hear more about when people start talking about American competitiveness. To say merely that Americans are not terribly good at foreign languages is sort of like saying that Russians are not terribly good at designer sportswear. The figures on foreign language education are scandalous. Try this. 85% of high school students take no foreign language at all, and only 5% study a foreign language for more than 2 years. Or how about this one? For every American studying Russian, there are over 350 Soviets studying English. The consequences are predictably disastrous. Not long ago, a Russian walked into the American embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, looking for political asylum, only to find that there was no one there who spoke Russian. And only 18% of CIA recruits are proficient in a foreign language. I suppose the other 82% are all put to work spying on Grenada. In the private sector, things are equally bad. The overseas offices of U.S. firms are more often than not run by managers who cannot speak the local language and who have little or no understanding of the local culture and business environment. The fact is that if our math and science skills were at the same level as our foreign language skills, you'd have people raising a bigger ruckus than they did when Sputnik went up. Yet American competitiveness depends as much on one as on the other. To be sure, some help is on the way. More and more states are introducing foreign language requirements for college entrance. Congress has appropriated some funds for increased foreign language programs, and the omnibus trade bill that recently passed the House includes further provisions along these lines. But we're not going to see any real change until the American people can overcome their traditional attitudes of indifference and suspicion towards foreign languages. Doubtless, many people feel this way because they associate foreign languages with immigrants and seem to suspect that mastery of a foreign language is a sign of divided loyalty. Certainly, it's a striking irony that in the midst of all this talk about competitiveness, there's a powerful political movement trying to end bilingual education programs. Programs designed, among other things, to help the children of immigrants become literate in their native tongue along with English. If we were thinking about this rationally, after all, we would regard bilingual populations as an invaluable national resource. But our attitude is also a hangover from our long-standing isolationist tradition. As someone once observed, Europe has always seemed a lot further away to Americans than America has to the Europeans. Even now, for example, American students show a pretty appalling ignorance of the facts of geography. Recent studies found that 40% of 12th graders don't know where Egypt is, and that about the same number believe that Israel is an Arab country. And the media don't help matters much. American television provides less information about foreign countries than that of any other nation in the world, with the possible exception of China. The sooner this changes, the better off we'll be. If we were any other nation in the developed world, we would be teaching foreign languages as a matter of course in every elementary school when kids are still young enough to catch on. It's not just that we need managers and diplomats who can do business abroad. After all, they'll still be a relatively small number of people. The important thing is to overcome the mentality that disparages foreign language study in the first place, as a step in coming to understand that we're only one of the players in the room.
Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Michael Crichton. He wrote the futuristic thrillers and dramedy strain Terminal Man and Sphere, his new book. Ken Tucker will review a new album by Jennifer Warnes of songs by Leonard Cohen, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review River's Edge, starring Crispin Glover and Dennis Hopper. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.